Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The future of pharmaceuticals in space. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. One company is testing drugs in orbit without the help of humans. After 7 months in space, Varda Space Industries landed its capsule back on Earth with a successful experiment to aid in the manufacturing of HIV treatments. This life-saving research could help people access the medicine at a lower cost. We'll speak with Varda Space's Mark Herbert and Wendy Shimada about this pharmaceutical breakthrough. Then, a new Lego rover is now on the market, but it's unlike any other toy NASA and Lego have made. We'll speak with CollectSpace.com founder and editor Robert Perlman about the new Lego set. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Varda Space Industries is on a mission to study pharmaceuticals in orbit without human help. The recent mission was the first time Varda Space launched their scientific instruments into space, testing an HIV therapy drug autonomously. The company successfully recovered a capsule which held the experiment back in February. So what does this mean for the future of medicine both on Earth and in space? Well, here to answer that question is Varda Space's Vice President of Business Development, Mark Herbert, and the VP of Autonomous Systems, Wendy Shimada. Mark, Wendy, welcome to the show.
Great to have you. Great to be here today.
Great to be here and have you. Yes.
Great to chat with you all. Mark, let's start with you and talk a bit about what are some of the benefits of manufacturing pharmaceuticals in space? Why go through all of this effort to do something that I assume is extremely complex, but also put into low Earth orbit and make it even more complex?
Yeah. So thankfully, people have addressed that question for over 50 years, primarily sponsored by NASA research. So going back to the late 70s with Space Station Skylab, moving into the Apollo Challenger missions and really solidifying into the International Space Station setting in early 2000s, there's been over 3,000 life science experiments that have been conducted in microgravity, primarily looking at space exploration, astronaut safety, while in long duration missions. But during those studies, they have uncovered that if you can remove convection, you can remove buoyancy, remove sedimentation, which is the benefits of going from a Earth gravitational field to microgravity or anti-gravity type setting, you can start to improve a lot of pharmaceutical properties. And most of those are relating to the ways that molecules crystallize and self-pack. And by having those crystallizations occur in a microgravity environment, you lead to higher quality crystals, higher purity crystals with less defects, and you can actually promote novel structures that would not be attainable on Earth.
What types of therapies or pharmaceuticals is this microgravity manufacturing best suited for?
So it's both applicable to small molecules and biologics. The current use cases that we're evaluating, again, are looking at crystallization to improve the dissolution of both small molecules and biologics and improve the way that you can actually administer these medicines to patients. One of the most promising studies that came out of the International Space Station was a study that was sponsored by Merck in 2018, where they looked at the crystallization of Keytruda, the largest selling oncology drug on the planet today. It did $25 billion of sales last year. Unfortunately to Merck and unfortunately to the patients, Keytruda is an IV injectable. So patients have to go into a hospital setting, sit there for multiple hours in that hospital setting to get their therapy. And that puts a tremendous amount of burden on the patients and the healthcare system. And so there's an opportunity for Merck to reformulate that drug into a subcutaneous route to reduce that burden on the patients in the healthcare system. Unfortunately, if you look at the crystallization of Keytruda on Earth, it does agglomerate. But if you take that same recrystallization and you run that in a microgravity environment, you prevent that agglomeration. And now you can actually use that material to develop a subcutaneous route. And so that's what we're taking our platform into the pharmaceutical industry in an unencumbered fashion, because a lot of those studies that were done in international space stations were greatly restricted due to astronaut safety and the what you could actually fly, because a lot of small molecules and biologics are made from hazardous substances. By doing those studies in our platform, we remove those restrictions and really open up the envelope of what can actually be discovered and evaluated in microgravity.
I think that's a good time to bring Wendy into this conversation then, Wendy. As Mark was mentioning, these kind of precursor studies have been done by astronauts on the International Space Station, but these types of therapies and pharmaceuticals, they can't be done because of safety concerns. So you have to create some sort of autonomous way to do it. How do you do that? I mean, again, when I think of pharmaceuticals and biological sciences, this is very, very complex stuff. How do you make this work?
We employ a pretty, I want to call it sophisticated, but it's also actually quite simple set of avionics, electronics, hardware, and software, basically all in conjunction to be able to produce the manufacturing profiles that we need for the various pharmaceuticals that we have. So part of kind of what we want to be able to do is really provide state-of-the-art software products to be able to make everything as autonomous as possible. For example, if there is a specific thermal profile or some sort of manufacturing profile that a particular drug needs to be able to go through, we really try to make it as hands-off for a mission operator here on Earth to be able to operate the payload. And what that does is allow the number of total people to operate or fly a particular vehicle to really be drastically reduced compared to the NASA missions of yore, or even nowadays. You can see a mission control full with 40, 50, 60 folks monitoring data, sending individual commands. Really try to push a lot of that software complexity onto the vehicle as much as possible. So it's kind of a click of the button, start, and you're done.
Let's talk about, because this is more than just on a whiteboard at this point. You all have flown some hardware and had hardware return. Tell me a bit about the most recent payload that came back to Earth.
Yeah, so we actually did launch our first mission. The W1 series last summer was our launch date. We spent 234 days in space, actually, and returned back to Earth on February 21st, just earlier this past year. So just about a month ago, the team is really, really thrilled and stoked to kind of have the vehicle back actually in Los Angeles now at our headquarters. Overall, the overall mission, I think, was pretty flawless from a payload and manufacturing point of view. After we had checked out the spacecraft in orbit, basically perform a number of tests to ensure that all the key systems are functioning as we expect. We were able to do a first-time manufacturing, just kind of a one-shot and done.
And tell me a bit about the spacecraft itself. What is the size? What's on board? What would I be looking at if I was in a room with it at this point?
We fly basically two things. One is the spacecraft bus, which we actually contract through an organization called Rocket Lab. So they make the spacecraft bus or the spacecraft itself, and provides things like power, propulsion, kind of like key communication systems to our vehicle, which is what we call the capsule. So the capsule, about 90 kilograms in mass. I have tried hugging it before and I could get my arms around most of it, but really we took a lot of inspiration from the earlier kind of passive re-entry capsules of, Hayabusa, or even very, very similar to OSIRIS-REx, which is a vehicle that re-entered last year. And so overall, the capsule is passively stable. It kind of, once it separates from the spacecraft, comes back to Earth on its own. And yeah, we were able to do a re-entry over Utah last month.
Yeah, and from a dimensions perspective, the capsules, our spacecraft, is about 1 meter wide, 1 meter tall.
Mark, I'm sure you wanted to hug that thing when it came back too. What did it come back with, and how successful was it from the pharmaceutical side of the mission?
The pharmaceutical success was equivalent to the hardware and the flight success as well. So what we evaluated in mission one was we studied ritonavir. So ritonavir is a a compound that is exemplifies solid state issues in the pharmaceutical industry. So ritonavir was developed by Abbott in the late 90s as a HIV therapy. 2 years after commercial launch of ritonavir, a new crystal form of the drug was noted in the actual formulation that was being administered to the patients. This resulted in safety concerns, and so they had a massive recall on the product, had a huge impact on overall sales. They took a multi-billion dollar sales hit. They were able to successfully reformulate the product and reintroduce it into the market, so the therapy is still on the market today. It's actually one of the components in Paxlovid as well. But we studied ritonavir again because it exemplifies solid state issues in the pharmaceutical industry. And so what we demonstrated on mission one is that we could actually successfully manufacture a metastable form of ritonavir and bring that back to Earth, do the full characterization. And concurrent with that, we ran quality controls of all the different forms of ritonavir in the flight. And so we confirmed that during launch, during the performance of the manufacturing operations, and during reentry, that we were able to retain all the materials in the original format. And so we confirmed that they were stable through the full sequence of operations, and we actually could complete the successful manufacturing of a metastable form while in orbit, again, which was the first fully autonomous manufacturing of a small molecule drug in space in the history of the world.
Moving forward, Mark, is this something that, in order to take advantage of the platform of low Earth orbit and the microgravity environment, all of the manufacturing has to be done in space? Or is this kind of like you can start it up in space and then what you bring back, you're able to manufacture even more? How do you scale this? Does this have to scale in orbit?
Yeah, I think the simple answer to that is no. I think the analogy I like to use for my family, and again, I'm from the Midwest, and so my family is a fairly simple people, is the sour bread starter. So we go up to space to, you know, do the manufacturing, make the initial discovery. And as we confirmed in mission one, whatever we discover in space, we can bring that down successfully and in the same component configuration that was actually, you know, manufactured in space. We will use that to template a process terrestrially. So once we have that sourdough starter, so to speak, we can use that to replicate that batch on Earth. And so we don't anticipate to actually have to go back to space for routine manufacturing. If there is a need to access the microgravity environment to support that manufacturing, we do have the ability to scale. And so one of the things we didn't talk about is the way we actually get to low Earth orbit is we ride share on a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket for our first launch, which was last summer. We were one of 30 satellites on the constellation. And so we have the ability to scale up by increasing the number of capsules per launch if we want to do the manufacturing in space, or we could actually change the configuration of the spacecraft to increase the capacity. And then the other thing to note, which the recent successful launch of Starship, again, capacity at launch, we don't anticipate that to be an issue if there is a need to go to space for routine manufacturing.
Finally, Wendy, what's next? I mean, are there going to be changes to the vehicle, or will there be another launch soon that is going to be doing some more research in low Earth orbit, capitalizing on the rideshare opportunities from an operator like SpaceX?
Yeah, great question. We do have another launch queued up for later this year. So the team is preparing for that. On that particular vehicle, we are scaling up the payload capacity. And so right now going through the process of increasing software, operational, and engineering capacity to accommodate for all those changes and capabilities. And so we're all pretty excited about that. We've learned a lot, certainly from our very first mission, trying to incorporate all of those lessons learned, grow the team, kind of grow the product a little bit as well. And yeah, really excited to do it all over again.
Mark, Wendy, congratulations and best of luck on the next mission. Thanks for joining us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
That was Varda Space's Mark Herbert and Wendy Shimada. Still to come, LEGO's Rovers, imagination and the future of planetary exploration.
Up to now, in the space line of things, when they built LEGO Technic space models, they were always based on a real spacecraft. And this Mars Crew Exploration Vehicle, or rover, and the two additional sets that came out on March 1st are the first time that LEGO has gone a fictional route, looking towards the near and far future as to what vehicles we might build to explore Mars.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The partnership between LEGO and NASA has been inspiring and captivating space enthusiasts for years, myself included, with sets that replicate spacecraft like the Space Shuttle or the Perseverance Mars Rover. But now LEGO and NASA have taken a new direction with one space exploration set, a totally fictional and futuristic Mars Crew Exploration Rover. Here to talk more about why this LEGO set is unlike the others is Robert Perlman, the founder and editor of CollectSpace.com. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Robert, before we get into our conversation, full disclosure here, in my peripheral, I can see my LEGO Saturn V and my LEGO Space Shuttle Orbiter here, so I will try to be as unbiased as I can, but I am a LEGO fan myself. How about you?
I am... Basically, a similar setup right across from me is my LEGO Saturn V, two different versions of their lunar module, Space Shuttle Discovery, the International Space Station, the Space Launch System. So, yeah, you could say I'm a little bit of a LEGO fanatic myself.
I've been out-LEGO'd by Robert Perlman, and that is not a surprise at all. Well, let's talk about new LEGOs that we've got. There is a new LEGO set out. It's the LEGO Technic Mars Crew Exploration Rover, but this is a little bit different than the ones that we are looking at right now, right? I mean, tell me a bit about this set.
Well, this is a new departure for LEGO Technic in general. LEGO Technic, for those not familiar, is a line within the LEGO collection of toys that focuses more on advanced models and usually working models. So, for example, they have a lot of sports cars, and in some of them, the engine works as the real engine would, not actually powering on, but the pistons move as they should, the mechanisms work. So it's meant to teach kids and adults how these systems work. Up to now, in the space line of things, when they built LEGO Technic space models, they were always based on a real spacecraft. And this Mars Crew Exploration Vehicle and the rover and the two additional sets that came out on March 1st are the first time that LEGO has gone a fictional route, looking towards the near and far future as to what vehicles we might build to explore Mars.
So it's near fiction. Explain that. NASA did have a kind of part in developing this set. What was that about?
Yeah, so LEGO decided that they didn't want to go pure sci-fi. They didn't want tractor beams and transporters and lasers or anything that would you look at it and go, this wouldn't actually exist. So they wanted, at least with the first set that was set in the near future, they wanted someone to look at it and be able to say, well, that could be the actual thing that NASA would use. And who better to tell them what NASA would use than NASA? So they set up a meeting with NASA engineers, and it was sort of a departure for NASA as well. NASA and LEGO have worked together for many, many years. They've designed sets together. But this was the first time NASA's advised on a fictional design that wasn't already based on their own concept. So LEGO came to them with a design that they had in mind, and then NASA told them what was wrong with it or what needed to be added.
And what was that? What did they say?
Oh, well, for the number one thing they told them initially was we would never be able to take that vehicle to Mars because there would be no way of getting it there, and there'd be no way of moving it around the planet, you know, other than driving it, because it was too long. It was too large. It wouldn't fit in any realistic rocket fairing, the protective shield that allows it to launch off Earth. And so you'd have to launch it in parts, and that's not what they were proposing. So LEGO went back, and the chief LEGO designer took this model and made a system so that by pushing a couple of levers, you can shorten the chassis. It folds in on it. And so it's still drivable in that configuration, although not meant to be, but it's specifically meant for showing that it needs to fit into a rocket fairing for it to get to Mars. Even though the set doesn't come with that rocket fairing or even talk about how it got to Mars, they wanted to show that realism. It also meant showing what it would actually be used for. Now, it is a two-seater rover, so it's for two astronauts. So NASA told them you need everything on board that the astronauts would need. As the chief designer at LEGO called it, it's a camper van for space. So there are living quarters, there is a galley, there is a table for sitting down and working, and then, there's a treadmill for exercising, although whether we would need that in the low gravity of Mars is still to be seen, unlike needing it becoming a necessity in microgravity. NASA looked at it and said, Well, you know, they need toilets on board.
That seems like a pretty big oversight, right?
And like, I thought they were joking. They were laughing just like yeah, you are right now. And they said, no, we're being serious. You need toilets. So they built a toilet in. And sure enough, when you look into the model, there is a very recognizable commode. But they also told them that they needed to show that the vehicle needed to be powered. So there is a fuel cell generator, power generator based on fuel cell technology, and you can deploy it from the rover using the included crane that offloads things from the back of the rover, and then plug it into a port on the side of the rover to show that you're refueling it. It also comes with canisters for that hydrogen and canisters for the water that the fuel cells produce. It comes with canisters for the crew's trash to be recycled, and canisters for science samples to be collected off the surface, and then logistics canisters for holding all the types of consumables and equipment that the crew would need. When LEGO showed NASA the design, they said, you know, when our astronauts come outside the rover, they are wearing spacesuits, and those spacesuits are bulky and they're not able to run and jump in them. So this is a rover that's on a large set of wheels. You're pretty much high off the ground. They need a way to get off the rover. And so they built in a lift, an elevator at the back of the rover to specifically allow the astronauts to get down to the surface. It's a much more detailed toy set than what you would expect from just a simple rover driving around the surface, or even what some Hollywood movies have shown us in terms of future rovers.
Which is, I mean, that's in designs for the current moon landers and such like that. So that's actually really, really cool detail there. A quick Google search, Robert, tells me that this is not the first LEGO commode. In fact, they are quite frequent. but I'm still stuck on the fact that they added a extra planetary commode in this particular design. So this is not the only LEGO set you mentioned. There are a few other ones that have recently been released. Can you talk a bit about these new LEGO Technics that are coming out, aside from the Mars Crew Exploration Rover?
So there is a vertical takeoff and landing cargo ship, which is part like Harrier jet that can land vertically. So VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing. But they didn't want to use futuristic technology to say, oh, it can just hover. It actually has jet engines. And it proposes that jet engines can be used in the Martian atmosphere. We've only just shown that rotorcraft can do that with Ingenuity as part of the Perseverance mission. We haven't yet demonstrated whether a jet engine that presumably needs oxygen intake could operate in the very thin atmosphere of Mars, but it's possible. And this model and what is really just a more advanced rover are both the far off future, meant to be, and like maybe another 50 to 100 years ahead of the Mars Crew Exploration Rover, to show that there's been an advancement of technology. But one thing that all three sets share in common are a similar colorway. So in the LEGO world, colors are a big thing. LEGO fans that like to build their own models, let alone the models that the instructions lead you to build, are always looking for the same part but molded in a different color. And it's rare for LEGO to introduce a brand new color that they've never used before. And for these three models, they've introduced two different new colors. One, a new part in a different color, which is the wheels. The wheels on the Mars Crew Exploration Rover and on the futuristic rover are gray. And the reason why they're gray is to sort of imply that they're metallic and not rubber. Because they asked NASA, could we have rubber tires on Mars? And they said that would be a bad idea because they could explode because of the pressure differential, or that they could become damaged and you really don't want to bother with having to change out a tire on Mars. They said that's why on the rovers that they send to Mars now, they use a composite or metal structure in their construction. And so the designers went to LEGO and said, we need to show that these are not the same tires that we've always been using, and we've always modeled our tires as black, which sort of reads rubber. And so can we mold these in gray? And they got permission. And so that was a big change. And then to sort of give this whole new look, this futuristic look, its own livery, its own independent look, they got permission to use a brand new, very bright orange, something like an international emergency orange that has parts molded in that color across all three sets. And so even though they're set at different times, they sort of still look somewhat alike, and you can get the idea that they belong to the same family of vehicles.
Robert, this is, as you mentioned at the start of our conversation, just a continuation of a long relationship between LEGO and NASA. What do each of the organizations hope to get out of this relationship? What's the motivation for LEGO to make NASA sets, and what's the motivation for NASA to continue to cooperate with LEGO to design these sets?
Well, both organizations have a strong desire to have outreach and educate children, students, and for some part, adults.
Yes.
So
you and I included.
So LEGO offers a medium by which you're reaching that audience, and it's something that they love to do, but that already has a built-in educational aspect to it, in that whatever it is, whether it's a fictional Mars rover or a model of the Taj Mahal or a medieval castle, you're learning something from building it. You're learning how it was constructed, or, you know, in the case of the castles, you know, why moats existed, or why castles were designed in a certain way to protect their inhabitants. And the same thing's true with the space models. Even though it's a toy, and even though obviously it's not built in the same way as the real vehicles are, because you're doing piece by piece brick building, you're still along the way learning why the vehicle was designed the way it was. NASA sees this as a great way of reaching audiences, and if, for example, with exposing them to their current plans of going back to the moon, and they partnered with LEGO on a set a couple of years ago, a number of models that were based off the Artemis plans. And LEGO sees this as not just a way of bringing authenticity to their products, but people really love space, and so it sells well. If it wasn't something that that the market was already responding well to, I don't think LEGO would do it. And so they not only get the benefit of having these great space models that sell well, but I'd be able to say that they're not just fictional models. They're endorsed by NASA or are based on NASA ideas.
Robert Perlman is the editor and founder of CollectSpace.com. Robert, thanks so much for joining and reminding me that I've got some more Legos to put together to catch up to you. Thank you so much for your insight, Robert.
My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media channels. Find us at AWTY Space. Are we there? Space, get it? We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. And editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.